This is audio from the book, Death and the Afterlife. 8 Evening Lectures on the Summerland. By Andrew Jackson Davis, 1826-1910. From nearly 200 years ago. Link to PDF edition, which is best to read. Dot. At the Battle of Fort Donelson I saw a soldier instantly killed by a cannonball. One arm was thrown over the high trees. A part of his brain went a great distance, other fragments were scattered about in the open field, his limbs and fingers flew among the dead and dying. Now what of this man's spiritual body? I have seen similar things many times, not deaths by cannonballs, but analogous deaths by sudden accidents or explosions. Of this person whose body was so utterly annihilated at Fort Donelson, I saw that all the particles streamed up and met together in the air. The atmosphere was filled with those golden articles, emanations from the dead, over the whole battlefield. Page 18, about 3/4 of a mile above, the smoke of the battlefield, above all the clouds that lowered upon the hills and forests of black discord, there was visible the beautiful accumulation from the fingers and toes and heart and brain of that suddenly killed soldier. There stood the new spiritual body 3/4 of a mile above all the discord and din and havoc of the furious battle. And the bodies of many others were coming up from other directions at the same time, so that from 1/2 mile to 3 and 5 miles in the clear, tranquil air, I could see spiritual organisms forming and departing thence in all directions. First the face, then the head, then the neck, then the shoulders and arms, the whole smaller than the natural body, but almost exactly like it, so that you could instantly recognize the form and features of your old friend, only you would say, "Why, James, how improved you are! You look brighter and more beautiful, don't you? Your countenance has more quiet and love in it." So entirely natural is the spiritual body which the good God has wisely planned and caused to rise out of this terrestrial filth and corporeal corruption. The man so killed, what was his sensation? It was for the time suspended. To him, existence was nothing. Just think of the case. He was a healthy, stout, strong Illinois mechanic, who had bravely gone out with his loaded musket to do battle for the stars and stripes which shall never go down. His sudden death was to his consciousness what the hammer is to a piece of flint. If a hard flint is struck quick enough, it will fly into impalpable powder. If struck with less speed, it would not be crushed nor destroyed. It is the suddenness of the stroke that surprises cohesion in the flint, as the cannonball for the moment annihilated the sensation of individuality in the man. Individuality usually returns, in cases of sudden death, after a few days in the homes of the Summerland. They are usually guided to some brotherhood, to some hospitalier, or to some open-armed pavilion, and there they are watched and tenderly cared for, as are all who arrive from lower worlds. When the time approaches for the spirit's awakening, then celestial music, or some gentle manipulation, or the murmuring melody of distant streams, or something like breathing passes made over the sleeping one, causes sensation to return, and thus the newcomer is introduced to the Summerland. So Professor Webster was 8 days and a half unconscious. You know that, in Leverett Street Jail Yard, in Boston, he was hung according to law and gospel. As soon as he was pronounced good enough to live, they legally and religiously killed him. The sudden concussion struck to the soul of the strong, healthy man, and he was instantly jerked out of his individual consciousness. For days he was spiritually watched. I was at the time stopping at the Brettel House, in Cambridge. Mount Auburn was my daily walk, the only academy, the only college I sought in which to learn these lessons. I went thither every day. I witnessed the execution of Professor Webster, yet I was not personally present. I saw the organization of his spiritual body in the air, and watched its ascension. I saw his situation every day between the hours of 10 and 12. I wish now to call your attention to the arrival and appearance of different persons in the Summerland. We find on investigation that all the inhabitants of the immortal spheres were born on Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and upon the other planets which have gone through the process of geologic growth. Spirits themselves nearly all refer to terrestrial beginnings. But spirit itself is only manifested, it never came out of terrestrial sources. Spirit, per se, is the universal, ever-present truth. The organization of the spiritual body is another question, which may come up for consideration on another occasion. It is a well-ascertained fact that persons always take places in the Summerland in accordance with their moral status, and not in accordance with their intellectual tastes, inclinations, or social condition. Place there is always a question of morals, that is whether the person has been, or is, spiritually loyal to truth, justice, and liberty, and the divine laws that regulate social relations on the higher planes of being, or whether the person has, by circumstances, or by the impulse of organization, been unfaithful to principles, and particeps criminis, partner in crime, or whether he is really innocent, having been the victim of a combination of unpropitious circumstances, or a sufferer from the fortuitous concourse of physical and spiritual accidents. In either case, the moral status determines the position and gravitation of the person in the Summerland. It is found that persons who go there with memories of conscious wrongdoing, carry with them just so much gravitation, so much personal density and moral darkness, and persons who have committed involuntary wrong, although partly as the victims of others, yet have the same density, but they do not suffer from the internal oppression which the other feels as a part of his own conduct. The accusing angel is memory. The theory that all people will sometime go before the bar of God, and that there is a systematic heavenly tribunal, is the sheerest fancy of a materialistic theology. Both God and nature are with you at all times. The interior principle of justice, whether you know it or not, is the ever-present bar of God at which you are arraigned and tried, and deathless memory is the accusing angel. It gives you the document setting forth your exculpation, or else it explains to you, beyond controversy, the all-sufficient grounds for your condemnation. The Summerland is vastly more beautiful than the most beautiful landscape of Earth. Celestial waters are more limpid, the atmosphere more soft and genial, the streams are always musical, and the fertile islands there are ever full of meanings. The trees are not exotics. The birds are literally a part of the celestial clime, every one having its lesson of divine significance. That which is nothing to an idiot is a great deal to an intelligent man. That is true in common things on earth, and it is true to a wondrous degree in heaven. When a person enters the by suicide or by murder, whether legal or illegal, or however else he may be introduced, the question is not how he came there, but what brought him. A man who was not strong enough to keep another from doing him a wrong, to say nothing of one who was not strong enough to keep from doing a deliberate wrong to others, is a subject of philanthropic caretakings and discipline. According to the heavenly code, I ought to have something more than the power to be loyal to justice and right. I must be strong enough to keep any brother from injuring me, and that without ever lifting a physical weapon before him. My spirit should keep from harm the soul of my brother who may be yet encased in bad circumstances, and moved by a propulsive organization. In the Summerland, these delicate ideas and finely shaded moral distinctions are recognized. And you will find yourself under a new government, a God code, instead of the laws of earthly judges and legislators. You will be surprised, and yet, most likely, you will say, it is about as I had supposed. Religionists are highly astonished because they are not taken immediately into the presence of the great Jehovah, or cast down in the low places where they fry souls in cheap brimstone. Some people who have been in the Summerland for years are still prayerfully expecting that the great day of judgment will come, and that they will either be caught up to a higher glory, or snatched down to some lower depth. When these persons communicate to mediums, they teach the notions of orthodoxy, even in the old Calvinistic and perpendicular style, and you would be constrained to exclaim, "What contradictions! Am I to believe in spiritualism when the mediums tell all sorts of contradictory things?" And popular newspaper men say, these spiritual things should have no conflict in them. Spirits should understand their own world as accurately as earthly minds understand common affairs. So says my political friend Horace Greeley, and so say others who reason in that superficial way. Now, look at earthly reports about the details of this war. Behold what contradictions. Is it reasonable to demand universal sameness? Is it natural to suppose that the man who went up from Africa, and the native of Turkey should each report from the next sphere exactly what an American would who died the day before yesterday, with all the twists and advantages of education in his memory? Sameness is what men demand who call themselves reasonable. The point now is, the evils of general society and the evils of individual passion, the unclean spirits and human demons, originate in the maddened mire of outward circumstances and hereditary organization. These mold and fashion mankind according to their own image and likeness. Sweet and good circumstances, however thickly they may cluster about, amount to almost nothing to a bad mental organization. I have heard worldly men say that they would be happy if they could have this and that, carpets, flowers, pictures, fast horses, and a great house in the city. Such men have something wrong in the head. They were born in bankruptcy and social discord. Society, two-inch persons, is merely a fleeting rush and a momentary flutter. Circumstances do not much control such characters, because their fathers and mothers gave them propulsive mental organizations, which no combination of circumstance has yet been able to fashion into better shapes. But this discord in character simply adheres, it does not inhere, hence on this point we differ with the whole religious world. Modern liberal clergymen are almost with us. Total depravity has gone down in the market, notwithstanding all the city evils and the tremendous civil war. There is scarcely a minister who will reaffirm the old doctrine of Baxter, Calvin, and John Knox. They get quietly over it. They somehow feel ashamed of having accused the golden image. It looks like an unprovoked slander against the finest piece of work that ever came from the heavens to mankind. I do not wonder that clergymen are ashamed of total depravity. They will presently be ashamed of many other things. We hold that these evils, these errors, these sins which rise out of the abdomen, from the region of physical phrenology, from the region of conditions, and out of social circumstances, will increase the spirit's gravitation beyond the grave. By your status you elect yourself at death to the place where you will be at home, be it good, bad, or indifferent, you will be in your own proper and congenial place, as are the fishes in the water and the birds in the air. If you feel mentally satisfied, like the sightless fish in the Kentucky cave, to dwell amid truths without aids, the good father and mother will have no objection. So in the summerland, where there are infinitely more truthful, new and freedom. If a spirit choose to be foolish, there is no arbitrary law against his choice. But, ever and anon, he comes under the genial influences of celestial teachers, and thus, slowly, he is brought out from his interior hiding places, and his mind is at last fully awakened. Randall's Island, near this city, gives off youthful candidates who receive the attentions of very sweet and beautiful celestial missionaries. Happiness very slowly comes to one who persists in the states of discord. Beautiful music, the fragrance of flowers, the luxurious melody of singing birds, and the musical voices of many waters, come only when you internally deserve them. 10,000 years may pass before one's internals are sufficiently pure and bright. Some will find on their spirit surfaces a shadow, a feeling of unrest, and an appearance of nebulous blackness. And there are persons in the summerland who have an atmosphere surrounding their spiritual bodies that similar characters would be ashamed to wear in this world. It is all the logical consequence of wrong and evil conditions in which the persons lived and died. But there is no despair among the leaders and members of the celestial brotherhoods. Of them, and concerning domestic scenes in the afterlife, I shall hereafter speak. Next headline, Scenes in the Summerland. In my father's house are many mansions, If it were not so, I would have told you. It does not as yet seem to be a part of human belief that the race should make progress as rapidly, as broadly, as completely in spiritual realities as in science and the common concerns of a very common world. The idea generally prevails that the race must repose on faith, and stand eternally still in all matters pertaining to the mysteries of God, while it is esteemed right to grow and improve in all things else and in all other directions. This subtle absurdity has crawled all the way through every creed in the religious world. All progress in science and general education within the last century points toward the discovery and disclosures of the Summerland. All the important and refining sciences, which verge on the spiritual, have come up within the last quarter of a century. Our navigators have within the last 100 years plowed through all the seas of the globe, have sought knowledge of the obscure, sequestered rivers, in remotest countries, and many of them have returned to tell us faithfully of their scenes and experiences. Only now and then a man has fallen upon the altar of discovery. Every such spirit has been carried through the North-West Passage to a world of grander dimensions. The interiors of the earth have been evoked. In answer to practical prayers they have divulged their arcana, and their inmost secrets have become our everyday facts, familiar as household words. Great mountains have been scaled, and distant heavenly planets have been measured. The expansiveness and perfections of the universe, above us and around, have been searched and mapped by our astronomers, and the familiar sun has been induced to become party to the finest pencillings, so that when we stand before the photographic magician, coming within the field of his camera and at the focus of his mystic glass, we seem to be facing a supernatural realm. The light instantly projects a shadow, paints your picture, and perchance also that of a departed friend, on the susceptible surface of an insensate plate. Thus all human progress in the imitative, in the speculative, and in the absolute, demonstrate the practicability of farther discoveries with reference to the great future home of the spirit. We find, in searching history, that human nature has been blessed, ever and anon, with inspirations that convey the elements and rudiments of truths that bloom in higher degrees of life. Instead, therefore, of rejecting the germs of mythology or the teachings of poetry, we are learning rapidly to receive them as essentially significant. Instead of impoverishing ourselves by a ruthless rejection of the multitudinous productions in the art, and science, and poetry, and music of the past, we secure to ourselves great opulence by learning that human genius is every age, when at the moment of its incubation, projects the germs and foregleams of great truths which live beyond the tomb, so that poetry and music more especially, and the singing of beautiful birds, and the breathings of flowers, and the loving soup of laughing rivulets and the great thoughts that come pouring into your ideality from these sturdy and grave mountains, all enter into the rudiments of that higher education which is designed to be completed beyond the stars. I affirm, therefore, that there is no absolute imagination, that a total falsehood is an impossibility, that the finest imagination is, in its spiritual essence, the nearest approach to an actual truth. However grotesque, however abhorred, yet divest the inspiration of absurdity and grotesqueness, and lo! You find the sweetest whispering of the eternal God. If you will permit me to speak with reference to myself, I will say that I have never read a poet in my life, not, I think, more than 3 pages of any such writings. I have had an object in this, but I do not expect that this will be true of me 8 or 10 years hence, for I now intend to cultivate some acquaintance with the externals of these inspirations. For, as I grow, I desire more and more to know, in the external, what the great writers and thinkers of the world have done, and already I feel grateful for what I have interiorly seen and clairvoyantly learned in the great human sphere about me. I have not read the Epic of the Starry Heavens, by the imaginative and inspired Harris, fearing that, should I read his production, it might enter into my memory, and thus become a portion of some subjective apprehensions or objective visions of the future. As many of you know, I have had a peculiar experience, and it is well for a moment, in justice to what I shall hereafter say, to allude to it. There is positively no imagination in what I shall disclose, but I leave the philosophy and the science of the experience to some future occasion. My reason for affirming that it is not imagination is, that I started with the conviction that the kingdom of heaven was a beautifully walled up city, paved with gold, with a vast throne in it somewhere, on the topmost throne the great Father and Creator of men, to the right the Son, and on the opposite side the Holy Ghost, while in the front, and all around, extending as far back as the limited population of the saved could extend, an amphitheater with no galleries, but all part of one immensely great proscenium, and that the enjoyments and occupations of the saints and saintesses consisted in an everlasting Methodist protracted meeting. No eating, no sleeping, no drinking, no amusements, but praying and singing, next singing and praying again, and lastly, just for a change of the program, praying and singing. While over the parapets, near the resplendent embattlements of the Golden Wall, one could see rolling and curling up, not the torment of the condemned cigar smokers merely, but the accumulated black clouds of unmitigated misery from the overpopulated regions of the devil and bit angels. I think this orthodox picture, or something akin, has been in your thoughts many times. This notion was started early with me. But when the time came to pass into the interior by the inductions of Tit's magnetic process, my thoughts soon changed. Very rapidly I lost all interest in everything that I had heard on the subject of religion, and thus I remained, not desiring to acquire further external knowledge. This condition lasted for some 4 years. At length the time came to divulge, in book form, what had been accumulated by the visions of clairvoyance. Clairvoyance is the mind's telescopic power of bringing distant objects close to the mind, a positive and perfectly certain faculty, a natural power of bringing the details of a distant scene as near as the flowers in the garden just beyond the window. However distant it seemed at first, the object or scene could be, by cultivation of the faculty, brought so near as to invite your footsteps. At length I became proprietor, so to say, of this cerebro-telescopic faculty, which before had only been loaned to me for occasional use, as by an artificial process. When I came into full and intelligent possession of this mental instrument, then began a series of private visional experiments, which I have continued from 1847 to the present time. And now a word concerning my habits with reference to these things, for my physical methods, I think, have a direct and important bearing upon the question. Whenever I wish to obtain these visional results by voluntary telescopic clairvoyance, I do not seek opium or hashish, neither Arabian, Hebrew, Bohemian, or Gypsy incantations, nor do I clog my digestive organs, nor highly stimulate my nerves, but that comes, as Daniel expresses it, a period of fasting, and of constant, though not over urgent desire. Sometimes have been obliged to continue this from 4 to 6 weeks before my nerve system was perfectly still, my blood cool, my senses indifferent to the outer world. Then I could concentrate the perceptive faculties and bring into action all the requisite organs, and, under the control of intuition, direct them upon remote earthly objects or scenes superterrestrial. If I had taken for food what is called a generous diet, or habitually engaged in these mental exercises at night, I should in either case have distrusted my discoveries. But I almost never have such an experience as a dream. I never attempt to get visions in the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men. My exercises, on the contrary, are between 6 o'clock in the morning and 12 o'clock of the same day. If I do not obtain my clairvoyant or other experiences during those hours, they do not come that day, for I do not then seek them. But if the spirit way is widely opened, and I am warmed and made enthusiastic by what I have seen during those hours, and feel, in my enthusiasm, that the after part of the day would be a luxurious gratification if it were similarly appropriated, I always say to myself, as a law, thus far, and no farther, never infringe upon the afternoon or night. Consequently, I do not write anything, or dream anything, or think anything of great consequence, during the after portions of the day, but live in a common social way from 12 o'clock, m., to 6 o'clock on the following morning. This has been my mental and clairvoyant habit for years. I have found it to be an orderly, cool, philosophical, successful way of getting the best results, the largest amount of spiritual happiness, and the true secret of keeping free and healthy and young in heart and body and head. I can truthfully say that it has required more self-control to repress the waves of heavenly joy and enthusiastic happiness that have rolled through my mind, and the effort has more taxed my mental powers, than have all the disappointments and inevitable trials which have come to me in the course of my history. Sometimes I have been powerfully tempted to indulge the state of clairvoyance a little too long, but never have been able to sustain, with profit and happiness, more than 3 hours of such occult investigations and exalted contemplations. During those mysterious hours, however, I have acquired facts and knowledge of things that would make an extensive volume, even if written out in the fewest and poorest words, and yet, when attempting to record the scenes and facts from memory, the expression would be the coarsest shell, the mere physical precipitation, of the spiritual realities that were thus born in the mind, beautiful scenes and great principles struggling through the incarcerations of language to come in contact with the memories and to become part of the judgment of my fellow men yet in the ordinary condition. I mention these things simply because they are psychological facts, and should have important bearings upon the general question of bodily and mental habits in connection with the exercises of the mind. I have met persons who said to me, "Why, Mr. Davis, are you not all the time conscious of the presence of the spiritual world?" And my answer has been, "No, I could not be and live." Others have asked, "Are you not personally and frequently in contact with spiritual beings?" And I have replied, "No. I could not be frequently in contact, and yet keep physically healthy and be mentally able to attend to the ordinary duties of my life." And again some ask, "Are you not constantly and consciously associated with ideas, and thinking of great principles?" And others seem to think that I should appear uniformly abstract, and look ghostly, like the last remains of an evangelical minister. Far from all these opinions are the facts, for I very substantially feel my feet within my boots, and my bodily sensations are strictly normal, are as solid and natural as those of any person in this assemblage, and I am generally free from disease and abnormal conditions. And yet my cerebrotelescopic experiences of the supermundane world have been an unbroken epic, the grandest spiritual poem. Indeed, it may not be safe to contemplate the celestial picture in its boundless affluence. For now, while reverting in memory to these things, I feel a heat gathering on the brain and quickening the thoughts, like one who has realized the focal concentration of the rays of immortal light, and felt their sublime breathings upon and within every fiber and faculty of his spirit. I will speak to you, therefore, as an observer tonight, and not as a seer. I will give you, in my own way, an account of things and places seen beyond the stars. Bayard Taylor would in like manner testify, though I shall not, perhaps, be able to use as good language as he, concerning his travels and discoveries in foreign climes. I shall discourse to you somewhat as does von Humboldt in his Cosmos, giving you accounts of great mountains and valley scenes, of streams traced to their sources, of distant lands and temperatures, of different peoples, climates, and soils. And what I shall relate is as strictly in harmony with the facts of science, with the laws of philosophy, and the developments of astronomy, and I hold myself ready to reconcile what I may utter tonight with all scientific and philosophical discoveries in astronomy, or in chemistry, or in the laws of light or color, or in the nature of substances or in the secrets of growth, or in the properties of material organization. For I do not think that spiritual truth is irreconcilable, incompatible, or out of harmony with the real laws and discoveries of science.